So this is
a combination workshop at Dharma Zephyr in Nevada on September 12th, 2009. Today's the Neurology of Awakening Day. And then tomorrow we're going to talk about no self in the brain. Tomorrow, for me, is really cool stuff. Today is going to be a lot about steadying the mind. That's a very foundational practice. But I'm also going to get into the parts of that in Buddhism that are about intense positive emotion. I love that stuff. Bliss, joy, happiness are really powerful, skillful means, and they have some very cool neurological underpinnings, which I'll explain too. So that's a lot of what today's about. Today's about steadying the mind and getting close to those states called the jhanas, which comprise right concentration or wise concentration in the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. It's the eighth element of the path. And we won't get into the jhanas today, but I will talk about potentially what some of the, you know, might be happening in the brain when people are having these extraordinary states. And certainly we'll talk about what happens in the brain in the preliminary factors that lead to those states of deep, deep meditative absorption, which the Buddha said were foundational for liberating insight. So that's a lot of today. And if you have never had any background with meditation or neuroscience, it's totally okay. But we are definitely going to go after the deep end of the pool, because that's what, to me, is where it's fun to swim. Anyway, I grew up in Southern California, so that's spent a lot of time in pools. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about no self in the brain, the idea of that everything's connected to everything else, so that there's nothing exists in its own right, including that elusive but very persistent sense of me. Right? And that's one of the really interesting things, too, and also where neuroscience has a lot to offer. Because if you look at the brain, self is widely distributed in the brain. It really is compounded. And it flickers up, flickers down, flickers left, flickers right. And when you look closely at it, there really is not a coherent sense of self. As I'll talk about it later, for me, self is a unicorn. In other words, what I mean by that is that if you think of a horse, right there you're thinking of a horse, right? And so you have a thought of a horse, an image of a horse. Definitely you have some kind of little neural circuit lighting up that supports the mind, the mental state of horse is supported by a neural state of horse. Okay? So that's a real representation that it exists of a real thing. Right? Think of a unicorn. Okay? That's a representation in your mind. You're thinking of a unicorn. You have a thought, you have the words, maybe a little history, you know, the white beautiful thing, you know, whatever, big long horn. But there are no unicorns. We constantly have thoughts of self, but there really is no self. There is no coherent agent behind, you know, actions or coherent owner of experiences really to be found. And that's a very deep subject that is kind of mind-boggling, especially when you first encounter it. But we'll get much more into that tomorrow. And the benefit of that, a lot, is around things like not taking life so personally. You know, not getting our knickers so much in a twist when things don't happen quite the way we want, or getting so grasping after things related to self-referencing. Or how many of you are in the helping professions or therapists by any chance? There are quite a few. Or getting so hungry for, in psych lingo, narcissistic supplies. In other words, those supplies out there in the world of approval, prizing, you know, you're awesome, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, that's what tomorrow's about. So, logistically, do most of you, if not all of you, have a handout? Okay? Okay, great. If you want to share, that's cool too. I think I could, we have one more, which is the master copy. I'm happy to share because I can see it in the slides. I brought my computer because some of the slides, we don't have a PowerPoint projector, and some of the slides are brain scans or other things, and it's kind of cool, and I'll turn it around and you can see it, or we can come closer and look at it, stuff like that. Okay, so my plan for today is to do a combination of practices, some of which are guided, to really go after deep states of steadiness of mind, following the Buddha's roadmap in that direction. And much as the Buddha said repeatedly, ehi pasiko, in Pali, see for yourself. Today, see for yourself. See what makes sense to you, see what doesn't make sense to you, and then keep what works and just leave the rest. So that's kind of the structure of today. I'll take, and also I will present a fair amount of information. So as day-longs go, this probably could be fairly information-heavy. That is what it is. Some of the information will probably, you know, really relate to you. Some of it may not. In those three circles, you know, Buddhism, psychology, and neurology, you may be more interested in one circle than others. That's okay, too. You know, it's kind of where they all come together. That's where the sparks fly. Okay? We're going to take some breaks. I'll take a break in the morning, then we'll have a lunch break, then we'll have an afternoon break, then we'll end at 5. We're really close to it. Feel free to get up and use the bathroom early. I think it's okay to have water and drinks in here, so just be comfortable. You know, really take good care of yourself. I'll move along pretty briskly, but the material here is embedded in those slides, mainly, and also this talk that's, you know, being recorded. Right. Any comments or questions so far about the logistics or the subject of the day? Yeah?
Do you want us to save questions to a specific time or question you as we go along?
That's great. Thank you for that question. Both are okay. In other words, I have carved out in my plan specific times for discussion, and if I roll along and something comes up, definitely please jump in. I love the fact this is a small group, you know, and we really can, there's more opportunity here in a smaller group to really talk about things. Thanks. Anything else? Any other question or comment? Okay, great. Well, let me say one thing and then let's do a practice. That'll then set up a lot of the themes for today. A fair amount of today is about working with your mind and deliberately trying to encourage certain wholesome states and discourage other states. Now, that's wise effort. That's right effort in the Noble Eightfold Path, obviously. But it's vigorous. It has a kind of vigor to it. And I just want to frame that. In other words, for me, there are three fundamental pillars of practice, in a way. There is working with the mind, being with the mind, and transcending the mind. And interestingly, those kind of correspond, pardon me, to sila, samadhi, and panya. In other words, sila is virtue or restraint or morality. That's a lot of the working with the mind. Samadhi or mindfulness is a lot about being with what's there. In other words, you're just being with what's there in kind of an open, spacious way. And then there's transcending, where we just see the larger whole. Or we see what's flowing through the mind as just this temporary and non-binding modification of awareness that doesn't really matter that much. That's a transcendent view. Or even if we're theistically inclined, we regard all this as just arising and disappearing in the divine, perhaps. Who knows? So that's the transcending part. Right? And that's the wisdom part, which is panya, or wisdom, the third primary pillar of practice. So all are important. I personally think the most important of all is transcending. Next is being with. Least important is working with. That said, today we're going to do a lot of working with. And so it's in that context that I want to kind of name that, because a lot of time in retreats and workshops, it's a lot about being with. And sometimes people say, why are we doing all this, trying to, you know, prod our mind in different directions? It's a little bit of a workout. The Buddha really emphasized the importance of being able to work with the contents of mind and to cultivate wholesome states. On the other hand, sometimes it can be frustrating. It's okay if I suggest you try to encourage something to happen and it just won't happen. That dog won't hunt that day, you know. That rocket won't ignite. It won't lift off. So be it. And then again, you know, the content of frustration may arise, and minimally you can be with that content, and you might even be able to work with that content of frustration if something doesn't ignite. Okay? So in that context then, I would like to take us through a guided meditation. If you've never meditated before, it's perfectly fine. What I'm going to do is get us settled, and then I'll give you 5 suggestions. And then I'll explain later why I gave you those suggestions in terms of what's happening in your brain while you're doing them. And then at the end of the 5 suggestions, I'll ask you to follow every single breath for 5 minutes. That's not easy to do. And that's about 75 breaths for most of us, ballpark, over a 5-minute period. And it's really okay if you can't do it, but just as a suggestion, you want to try to follow each breath from beginning to end. And during those 5 minutes, think of it as a renunciation practice. In other words, you're devoting yourself to the breath. You're having even a warm feeling, a happy feeling toward the breath. You're falling into the pleasant, positive sensations of breathing and abandoning everything else, letting go of everything else for that 5-minute period. It's a mini micro renunciation practice. Okay? So that's what we're going to do. So in your own way, find a posture that helps you feel comfortable and alert. you're welcome to leave your eyes open. Many people let their eyes close. If you want to do this standing or seated or even walking, that's perfectly okay, or lying down. Generally, staying seated is best. And helps to just kind of have a general sense of kind of relaxing and being here for yourself. So let's sit for a minute or two, and then I'll give you the first suggestion. Okay, the first suggestion is to form an intention for this meditation, perhaps with words or even wordlessly. One way to form that intention is to get a sense, a bodily sense, of a teacher, the Buddha, perhaps, as if that being is meditating here as you. But however you do it, take a moment to establish an intention for this sitting. The second suggestion, and by the way, you can go at your own pace if you want to focus more on one suggestion than the rest of them, and I'll keep going. The second suggestion is to relax. For example, take a really big breath and fully exhale at least once and even a few times. Feel the tension leaving your body. Really relax. All right, the third suggestion is to bring to mind as much of a sense of safety as you can. Perhaps a sense of being in a protected setting here, among good people, a growing sense of safety, perhaps related to a sense of your own strength. feeling safer to whatever extent you can, more able to relax vigilance and bring attention inward. Okay, the fourth suggestion is to see if you can bring to mind some positive feelings, perhaps quite gentle or mild ones, but positive nonetheless. Perhaps a sense of happiness at being able to do this today, peacefulness, maybe gratitude for some of the good things in your life. Perhaps a sense of contentment. As you can, see if you can turn up the dial on positive emotions. Not forcing it, but falling into them, encouraging them. Perhaps embodying positive emotion with a little smile. All right, and the fifth suggestion is to get a sense of the benefits, whatever they may be, of this meditation sinking into you, nurturing and helping you, becoming a part of you. soaking into your body. Increasingly inclining your mind in an ever more positive direction. These positive experiences and perhaps insights becoming part of your body, woven into your being. On the basis of these five foundational practices, see if you can be aware of every single breath for the next 5 minutes. Simply aware of the sensations of breathing, perhaps felt in the belly or the chest or around the upper lip or in the body as a whole. Resting attention on each inhalation from beginning to end, and then each exhalation beginning to end, letting go of everything else for the next 5 minutes. How was that? What did you experience?
Bliss.
Bliss. What?
Very nice.
Ah, great. Thank you. Other people?
Very calm. And concentrated.
Difficult to follow every breath.
Miserable failure.
I caught a few here and there.
What did you... Go on, please.
I thought it helped what we did before the last 5 minutes to establish quiet. It helped, and I think I was more focused on the breath than I normally am.
Yes. How did you experience those five suggestions or any one of them being useful?
I think it was kind of a progression of just getting quieter, and especially when you talked about being happy. I don't know why, but for some reason my mind really quieted and I was just okay with everything.
Right. Yeah. Great. Any other comments on especially the suggestions?
I liked when you said to picture the teacher within us. I sometimes picture someone sitting in front of me, like Deep Ma, but I hadn't pictured it within my own body, and I thought that was very helpful.
How was it helpful for you?
I just felt confident and empowered that I could do it.
Yes. I'd like to talk about what might have been happening in your brain when you were doing those five suggestions. But before I do that, I just want to acknowledge that, isn't it so interesting? We did that for about 10 minutes, and the room is completely quiet, right? It's so interesting that doing an immaterial mental activity, think about increasing safety, form an intention, be a little happier, right? Rest attention on a breath. Something that's immaterial would have such an obvious, palpable impact on the body. The body feels different, doesn't it? And that really gets at probably the central point of one of the central points of today, which is that the mind and the body, the mind and the brain, the mind and the nervous system really are one integrated system. And so I want to illustrate that with some examples. So, for example, and you can take a look at your handout. Let's see. If you take a look at the Foundations of Meditation slide, the third one, I think, on the first page. The third one on the bottom of the first page, Foundations of Meditation. I'm going to go through each one of those 5 points. So first off, if you're setting an intention, you're doing two things. One is top-down from the frontal lobes, which really tend to establish intention and then sustain sort of executive top-down control over what we do. But you're also establishing an intention from the bottom up. We often think about intention as something that's verbal or, you know, it's kind of like the internal chair of the committee or the big boss upstairs says, keep doing this, right? And that's an important form of intention. But a lot of the really powerful forms of intention are not verbal, they're not even terribly conscious, and they're embodied emotionally, more in the limbic system, in the lower regions of the brain. And I'll talk a little bit about brain structure later, but just kind of follow that. And so when you do something embodied, like imagine your intention as an expression of a teacher or someone who represents that intention, that value, that purpose, that direction, then you're really embedding it in your being. And you naturally then move in that direction rather than have to be pushed in that direction by top-down executive control. Okay? Okay. Second, relaxing the body. It's so interesting how much relaxation is a part of traditional monastic practice. And later on I'll talk about tranquility as well as a theme that's really talked about a lot. It's when you do that, for example, there are two wings of what's called the autonomic nervous system. This is the part of the nervous system that responds to changing conditions, tries to maintain an equilibrium. There's three wings. One of the three is called the enteric wing. It has to do with digestion. We're going to acknowledge it and set it aside. The other two are the sympathetic and parasympathetic. Sympathetic wing deals with response to stress, including getting upset. If we're anxious or irritated or sad or ashamed, in any way upset, those are the four primary negative emotions and they're on a spectrum, anger, fear, sadness, and shame. When that happens, the sympathetic wing of the nervous system activates as well. It isn't just a lion jumping out of the bushes or someone running a red light and about to hit us that triggers sympathetic arousal. It's getting mad or feeling afraid, right? That activates the sympathetic nervous system. The counter to the sympathetic nervous system is the parasympathetic nervous system. If the sympathetic is the fight or flight system, the parasympathetic is the rest and digest system. So if you imagine, if you see a lion there just after a big meal or how we feel, you know, kind of in the afternoon after a nice lunch and everything's okay, that's parasympathetic arousal. So when you exhale, you activate the parasympathetic nervous system. When you inhale, it's sympathetic. And the two are like a seesaw. They work together, but when one goes up, it pushes the other one down. So when you get sympathetic arousal, it downregulates the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system. Alternately, when you get parasympathetic arousal, it downregulates the sympathetic wing. We evolved to have a resting state of parasympathetic activation, where we're pretty mellow. That's our resting state. If you, for example, cut the nerve tracts of the sympathetic wing of the nervous system, you can keep living. But if you cut the nerve circuits of the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system, you'll stop breathing, your heart will stop beating, you'll die. See, parasympathetic is baseline. Sympathetic arousal gets all the news, right? It's in the news, it's in the movies, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, that's sympathetic arousal. There's a lot of positive emotion wrapped up sometimes in sympathetic arousal. Yay, my sports team! Yay, my daughter finally shot a basket! I offered her a dollar for every time she would just shoot when she was like, you know, third grader, and, you know, to finally get her to do it because she was afraid she would miss, and we finally got her to shoot, and it was great. And once she made it, boy, I had a lot of sympathetic arousal right then and there, you know? It's not just bad, but chronic sympathetic arousal is really bad for the mind and body. It wears on health. It has a lot of negative health consequences. And we live in a time where there's a lot of chronic, low-grade sympathetic arousal. So it becomes really important to become a master of the parasympathetic wing of your nervous system. Remember, it's like a seesaw. If you activate this parasympathetic, you push down the sympathetic. And there are a number of skills for activating the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system, like exhaling, relaxing the body. Another good one is kind of silly. You can follow along if you like. There are a lot of parasympathetic nerve fibers in the mouth, and there are a lot of also positive parasympathetic associations to eating, nursing, suckling, kissing. So people who work with really troubled young children or horses will touch them on their mouths to calm them down. So if you're ever feeling really upset and you want to calm yourself down, you can always go like this. Parasympathetic arousal. Laughter is parasympathetic arousal as well. Yawning is parasympathetic arousal. Okay? A lot of good ways to do that. So, relaxation. Third, feeling safer. That's a really important technique and often gets controversial when I, you know, suggest it to people. As I said, our resting state, I think of our resting state through evolution as the five C's, is a way to think about it. It's conscious. In other words, the brain is really, really conscious. It's hard to make the brain unconscious. You could take out the whole frontal lobes, and you could take out the whole cortex. You could have a conscious brain. You're conscious. You're aware. Wouldn't be very smart, but you'd be aware. Even when we're sleeping, we're basically conscious. there's just literally a lot of paralysis of the body. That's partly why when you're in REM sleep, you have dreams sometimes where you feel like you're being chased and you can't get away, or you're trying to hit the bad guy and it's like your hand is moving through water, you know. That's because there's paralysis of the motor circuits during 25% or more of your sleep, which is REM sleep, where you're having the most active dreaming. Because if you didn't paralyze your body, you'd come fully awake and interrupt the beneficial functions of sleeping. So if the brain wants to be conscious, so C for conscious, calm, that's parasympathetic arousal, contented, our resting state is mildly positive, effectively, for most of us, our natural resting state. Caring, we're very, very social. I'm not going to talk a lot about relationships and relationship stuff in this weekend, but we evolved to be very, very caring, very altruistic and cooperative toward us, and alas, fearfully aggressive toward them. That's a whole conversation for another workshop. And then last, we're creative. So the five C's. So that's our resting state, okay? But we're driven from home. That's our home base. We're driven from home really fast, particularly around threat. We're incredibly threat sensitive, right? Because our forebears, who were really all chill, you know, our monkey, squirrel, lizard-like forebears, you know, spanning hundreds of millions of years of evolution, the ones that were really good meditators, wow, look at the light on the leaves. Wow, I feel one with everything. Chomp! You know, they got nailed. The squirrels, monkey, primate, hominid, human ancestors who are nervous and cranky, irritated, and like, what's up? Constantly scanning, really neurotic. They lived to have a lot of grandchildren. And here we are today, their grandkids. All right, so we're very prone to leaving home under any sense of threat. And so that's why it's really important to cultivate a growing sense of safety. There are two great mistakes we can make in life. One is, well, there are many great mistakes, but two of the great mistakes are these. One, we can think there's no tiger when there really is a tiger. That's a big mistake, right? To underestimate actual threats. On the other hand, there's another mistake, is where we think there's a tiger, but there isn't one. Or there is a tiger, but it's stuffed. Or there is a tiger, but it's in a cage. Or there is a tiger, and it's a baby tiger. Or there's a tiger, but it's just a picture of a tiger, right? Or there's no tiger at all. That's a really, really big mistake. In this life, which of those two mistakes do most of us make more often? What?
There is a tiger.
You mean that there, but there is none? Or what? Exactly. We think there is a tiger, but there isn't one. I think that's exactly right. We live often in a state of fearful, low-grade, fearful vigilance when there really is no threat. The people we're with are not the people we grew up with, right? The resources we have today are vastly superior to the resources we had as kids. Our options today are much greater, and our capacity to cope with what happens is much greater. But we often still live with that kind of low-grade sense of unsafety that's way out of proportion to the actual unsafety that is real. In this world, you know, the Buddha taught, there is no perfect safety. No one escapes old age, disease, and death, right? Stuff happens. People run red lights. You can do the best job in the world. Your corporation gets bought, downsized, you get a pink slip. Right? People get ill. Wonderful people trip and fall and break a hip, you know, and a leg. Things happen, right? There's no perfect safety, but there can be greater safety. Now, an important carve out to acknowledge here is that for some people, feeling safer makes them feel really anxious. Because it's when you feel safe and lower your guard that they really get you. Particularly people with any kind of a trauma history. So I want to really call that out and acknowledge that. I think it's very important to call out. And if that's so, then it's really important to work artfully with this growing sense of safety, right? But that said, to feel more at peace and less threatened in proportion to what is actually true is a really good thing. Because among other things, when we feel less threatened, we feel freer to love. It's hard to be really loving when you feel threatened, right? It's hard to feel really gracious or generous or focused toward the future. If you feel threatened, you know, the whole horizon narrows to the immediate present and the immediate danger. It's also hard to bring attention inward for spiritual practice. I don't think, you know, if you think of the Buddha's instructions, find a place of seclusion, which is to say safety, you know, establish mindfulness, and then go deep, right? That's the Buddha's instruction. It's an interesting metaphor that he had his own awakening with his back to the Bodhi tree. The tree had his back, because that's where threats most come from. That's where we're most alert. It's what could be sneaking up from behind us, right? Mara came from the front. The Bodhi tree had his back. So to the extent that you can feel increasingly safe, accurately safe, safe and grounded in truth, you know, the better able you are to bring attention inward for deep practice. Okay? What that does neurologically, as you can see in the little handout there, is when you feel safer, you're using frontal lobe activity by bringing conscious awareness to slow down the limbic system, which is the emotional system in the brain. And in particular, its alarm bell, the amygdala. The amygdala is constantly tracking what's happening, pleasant or unpleasant, pleasant or unpleasant. That's the vedana, or feeling tone, in the aggregates in Buddhism, one of the five main components of experience. And if it detects anything unpleasant, blap, 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 you know, it starts pulsing an alarm to keep you alive so you can have grandkids, you know, or pass on your genes in some way. Okay, blap, blap, blap. So when you feel safer, you're quieting the amygdala. And over time, you're helping desensitize it. And you're also building around it circuits of, you know, kind of calming and soothing. Right? And then next, positive emotion. This is one of my favorite ones. It's so interesting how Buddhism gets this rap as this sort of dour, ascetic, bummer religion, right? Man, suffering sucks. Die. Yuck. Oh, well. Rebirth. Do it again. Can't get out, you know, right? It's so bad news, I'd blow my brains out, except I'd come back, you know, and then I'd suffer more. Like, right? It has that downer quality. What a buzzkill. But no, I mean, so much of actual practice, the Buddha's instruction, is to cultivate positive emotion, is to cultivate joy. Of the five factors, which we'll get into, for deep states of absorption, 2 out of 5, or arguably 3 out of 5, involve positive emotion. One is bliss, rapture, piti in Pali, the language of the earliest written surviving written record of the Buddha's teachings, or sukha, which the root of that is Sanskrit, also means sucrose or sugar. It's sweet. It's happy. You know, happiness is skillful means. Interestingly, neurologically, when we feel positive emotion, we're getting an increase in dopamine. Dopamine is a really important neurotransmitter. And we're also usually getting an increase in norepinephrine, which is also released when we're stressed, but a little bit of sympathetic arousal can be a good thing. And norepinephrine is a cousin to adrenaline, and it's very involved in what's called brightening the mind. You know, the traditional instruction of brightening the mind, which is accomplished sometimes in Tibetan Buddhism by visualizing light, it probably corresponds to a certain amount of norepinephrine release in the brain. What that does, the two of these, dopamine is associated with rewards, and norepinephrine is associated with alertness. So when you're experiencing positive emotion, I think some of you talked about that, what that does in part is it helps you be rewarded by the wholesome mental state, and what that does is it really builds neural structure. In other words, when people are in a positive state of mind, they're having a lot of dopamine, and dopamine encourages neurons to make connections. In other words, we learn a lot under that condition. That's why, for example, if you want kids in school to learn how to do long division, get them happy. Then they're going to really learn. They're also going to put up with a boring madness of the procedure of long division, right? But people learn better when they're happy because that promotes forming neural circuits. Same with norepinephrine. We're more alert. And the two of those together really tend to help stabilize attention. And I'll explain later why this is, but I'll do it right now as well. So a key practice in Buddhism is mindful awareness, right? That's what we constantly get taught, we constantly get trained in. It's interesting to really try to understand then, what is mindfulness? When you're mindful, you're stably attentive to something. So you're, and in particular, if you're doing a concentration practice, which is a subset of mindfulness. Concentration is an aspect of mindfulness. You're both mindfully aware, you're stably attentive to a stable object, like the breath. You're not doing open space awareness where you're stably aware of whatever flows through the vast open space of awareness. But instead, you're really burrowing in to one particular object of attention. It could be even a statement, like a loving kindness practice. May beings be happy, right? Or you're maybe having an image, like in Tibetan Buddhism, a lot of the practices are visualization practices. Whatever the object of awareness is, and traditionally it's the breath, and that's the one I'll be using today, and you're very welcome, by the way, to switch it, even to a mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, or whatever your mantra may be. The point is that, how do you stabilize an object of attention? Because that's really weird, neurologically. Because, again, our forebears were who got sucked into one thing, didn't notice what else was going on around them, right? So the way attention works is really kind of interesting. You got to be able to do three things. You got to be able to hold something in awareness, and you got to be able, actually two things, and you got to be able to switch stuff out of awareness. The way that works neurologically is kind of like this. It's like there's a mental chalkboard upstairs, right? The chalkboard holds contents, you know, like the sensations of the breath. There's a gate to that little chalkboard, all right? So when the gate is closed, you can only pay attention to one thing. When the gate pops open, new information rushes in, and you start thinking about the dishwasher that you forgot to empty, or the fact that your husband didn't empty it and he's supposed to, or something like that. You know what I mean? Okay, or your teenager, whatever. Or wife, who knows? But anyway, so what keeps that gate open or closed? Steady dopamine keeps it closed. If dopamine drops, the gate opens. If you get a spike of dopamine, the gate opens. In other words, imagine a monkey in a tree. Okay? Monkey's eating bananas in this tree. Steady rewards, bananas, yum, yum, yum. That means steady dopamine. That keeps the gate closed. The monkey just stays focused on the bananas in this tree. When the bananas in this tree run out, the rewards run out, the dopamine levels lower, and suddenly the monkey starts looking around. Where are those other trees? Looking for opportunity. Where are those other bananas? See? On the other hand, while the monkey's chomping in the tree with steady dopamine, and some cute other monkey pops on board this tree, woohoo! Spike of dopamine. Real opportunity. Gate opens. Right? Move off of bananas. Cute other monkey. Who knows? What might happen here? See? So in that case, then, you notice the other monkey. It's a really simple system, but it's ingenious, isn't it? So the question becomes then, if you want to have absorption, how do you get steady dopamine? A great way to get steady dopamine is to have lots of positive emotion, because that raises dopamine levels to their ceiling. They're not dropping, and you can't get a spike because they're already really high. Do you see that? Do you understand that? Isn't that so cool? That is the neurological explanation for why bliss and joy and rapture are factors in the jhanas. You know, these deep states of non-ordinary states of awareness, ecstatic states of awareness sometimes. You know, you get that really high dopamine, and I've had experiences in meditation where, like, it was hard to get up. It was, like, hard to go on a bathroom break because I was so sucked in, right? It was just so absorbing. Have you ever had that sense? I don't know, maybe. That corresponds to really high dopamine. See? So getting better at being able to awaken at will positive states of mind, not ignoring the bad news in life, but I don't think there's any shortage of negative emotion in this world, right? It's not like where everybody's running around like Pollyanna. Woo-hoo, woo-hoo. No, you see a lot of people who are pretty bummed out, even though their life's pretty good. So there's a place for really cultivating at will positive emotion. And one of the wonderful ones is gratitude. That's a really great one. That's a reliable gopher. Because you want to find those things that if you just think about them, they make you happy. Okay. Last, absorbing the benefits. That's an incredibly important one. I was talking with Harry earlier today about that. If you think about an evolution, we really... you know, we needed to learn how to approach the positive and avoid the negative. Approach the pleasant, and avoid the unpleasant. So we have these feeling tones, moment to moment to moment, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay? And the brain and the organism has learned to really go after the pleasant and kind of, you know, resist the unpleasant and kind of blow off the neutral. So we have greed, hatred, and delusion right there. Okay? Greed for the pleasant, hatred for the quote-unquote greed, quote-unquote hatred, quote-unquote delusion. You know, hatred for the unpleasant, delusion for the neutral. And in evolution, avoiding sticks is a lot more important than getting carrots. You know, we want to get the carrot of the pleasant, we want to avoid the stick of the unpleasant, but what's more important? It's the stick. If you get if you miss a carrot today, you'll usually have another shot tomorrow. But if you don't avoid the stick today, you will not get a chance at carrots tomorrow. So there's a negativity bias in the brain. The brain is primed to go negative. Its resting state is neutral to positive, but it's ready to go negative at a moment's notice. There's been a lot of really interesting research on the so-called negativity bias of the brain. For example, people at the end of the day are much more likely to remember negative things than positive ones. And that's what they dwell on, right? You've had a really pretty good day. What do you think about at the end of the day? That one weird inner conversation with your sister-in-law and the last word she used. What was that word? Why did she say that? Or, you know, Gottman's research on couples where it needs roughly around 5 positive interactions to neutralize a single negative one, to just bring you back up to the, you know, waterline. And sometimes it's closer to 10. Anyway, you see, because the negative has a lot of impact. The problem then is that since the brain preferentially looks for the negative, focuses on the negative, stores the negative, and then recalls the negative, over time we build up this growing pile of negative implicit memories. It's not so much that we remember what happened, it's that our bodies remember the emotional residue, the negative emotional residue. So even though most of life is neutral to positive, you know, the brain, that just flows through. The brain is, you know, like Teflon for positive experiences, but Velcro for negative ones. The negative ones stick in the sieve, the positive ones just flow through naturally, unless they're a $1 million moment. What happens? It's an incredible neurological injustice, right? It's a total injustice. We start forming this growing pile of negative implicit memories that forms our outlook, the way we see ourselves, the way we see other people. It also makes us very sensitive to a negative event here and now that's actually negative. We have this preamp in the brain that gets that negative signal and then boosts it because of that negativity bias in the brain. And then we overreact and then we create these negative cycles with other people who are reacting with their own little lizard brain negativity bias to our negativity bias, and then rock and roll, right? Just there you are. Welcome to my marriage, or something. Not exactly. It's a little better these days, especially. Practice helps, thank you. But anyway, so what do we do about it? One great way to do is to really focus on small positive events every day and take them in. Take in the good. Really focus on those true little things. The smell of an orange. The fact that you woke up again today. You know, Obama's the president. Whatever. I'm not going to do politics from the front of the room. But, you know, whatever it is, you accomplished something. Or you recognize some good quality in yourself. You made sincere effort today. There's something to be grateful for. Someone was kind to you or caring or a good thing happened. Or you even just recall a good thing. That's an opportunity to have a positive experience, which you then dwell on. That's the key. We have to dwell on it for 10, 20, 30 seconds straight. Because that's what causes the memory circuits to really form structure, right? Negative experiences are fast-tracked. Positive experiences have normal memory circuits. And normal memory circuits form structure based on intensity and duration of experiences. So you want to intensify positive experiences and really make them last. So they really soak in, okay? And that's that last thing we were doing there. And that is consistent with what the Buddha talked about in terms of bhavana. What's called bhavana or cultivation. We're cultivating wholesome qualities. You know, we're increasingly inclining the mind in a positive direction. There's a traditional saying that what the mind rests upon, the mind takes the shape of that which it rests upon. So if we're dwelling on negative thoughts, negative preoccupations, a sense of threat, a sense of discontent, you know, the hole rather than the donut, our mind will gradually take that shape. If, on the other hand, in lots of little moments, daily little moments, we rest our mind upon what's positive in ourselves, in other people, in the world, our mind will gradually take that shape over time. And the larger point here is the law of little things. It was a lot of little things that messed us up in the first place. And usually, sometimes there are a few big ones thrown in just for frosting on the, you know, it's like the turd on the cake, right? You know what I mean? Those are the ones that really, ew. But it's all the little components of the cake that really direct us in one way or another. So it's a lot of little things that are going to take us into a positive direction. And for me, that's incredibly hopeful. There's nothing you can do about the past. You can't even do anything about this exact moment, because once this moment has arisen, it's set, right? But what we can do in this moment is create the causes and tend to the causes of a better moments to come for ourselves, and then through ripple effects, all the other people around us, even, who knows, the whole wide world. And to me, that's the heart of practice, and that's really my focus today. What can we do here and now in lots of little ways that are grounded in reality, you know, and in nature, that are rested in our nature, that will make a big difference for ourselves over time? Okay. So, comments, discussion, questions at this point? Then we'll take maybe a little break. So, comments, discussion? Yeah.
Well, I noticed with the five suggestions that I had to have a real willingness to let go of some negative thoughts I was having, some regret or something like that. And I could really feel that idea of the executive attention trying to push those away, and that doesn't work.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting to kind of acknowledge that, let that be, but keep allowing and building the other suggestions and just sort of trusting that they would have some momentum. Because that negative was very, you know, it's like, no, I really want to work on that. You know, like what she said, what I said, what the look was, you know.
Yeah.
And to really let go of that, it took a very strong intention. So I think starting with the intention probably... Now that I think about it, it was very helpful.
Yeah, thank you. I got
because
it.
Because if I want to go toward Kuan Yin, I can't be, you know,
right.
Probably not going to help change me, figure out what to do differently.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah,
yeah, very useful. Yeah. Yeah, Susan.
I was late this morning because I had a tiger in my backyard.
A real one.
The words that you said were so perfect. I live on a desert hill across the way, and we had a fire last night. And I do really well in those pressure situations. And I jumped in my car to see how far up the hill it was, to see how panicked I need to be. Did I need to wake up my neighbors? And I have a wonderful neighborhood, and my neighbor was doing the same thing. And you know, we figured that part out. And then the trucks came, and you know, everything was going to be okay. And I went home, and I could not stop from obsessing about preparing to leave. Like, what did I need to take? What about my animals? And I think about those things because I've always lived in rural Nevada for 20 years, you know, and so I already have a base from that. But it was like I almost had to sit on my hands to not obsess about packing things, even though I knew that it wasn't necessary.
Yeah.
And then, so it took me a long time to go to sleep. So I was late this morning, and from what you said, I think I did exactly the right thing this morning, which was I walked around my property, I watered things, I played with my animals, I took my time getting here, and I think that from what you said, I did just the right thing to calm myself from all that adrenaline is just amazing in a circumstance.
Yes. Two quick little points about that. Thank you. The first is that the nature of the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system, it doesn't use hormones very much. So it mostly lights up neural circuits, which means that you can get snapped out of parasympathetic arousal really quickly. But, alas, sympathetic arousal uses a lot of hormones. It's wired into the endocrine system. So it triggers these releases of chemicals, like squirts, of cortisol, adrenaline, norepinephrine, other chemicals, and those chemicals take a long time to metabolize out of your system. Haven't you ever had the experience where you, like, the phone rang and you got really alarmed that it meant something, and you picked it up and it was perfectly fine, okay, maybe even good news, and you hang it up and your mind knows, good, it's fine, but your body is still rattled for 20 minutes. That's because it takes that, you know, or longer, or an entire night long. So that's the first point, and that goes to me, the importance of catching these sympathetic triggers quickly, these threat triggers quickly, and trying to get in the front end of that whole cascade. You know, and that's where practice comes in. With practice, you get quicker and quicker and quicker at it, where literally within a few seconds, you're starting to label it. What is this? I know you, Mara, right? This is a threat trigger, okay? Am I on my own side? That's incredibly important. I'm for myself, right? I don't want to suffer this. It's unfair. I want to be on my own behalf. That's good for me. That's good for the world. It's a very important attitude. It took me a while as a therapist to realize how many people are not on their own side. You know, I survived my childhood. It wasn't so horrible. It wasn't so bad, but still, because I was on my own side. And so it was hard for me to get that other people weren't. But I realized a lot of people are not for various reasons, a lot because of their own childhoods. You know, so being on your side is really important. And then you form an intention, just like Kathy said, and then you start mobilizing resources, hopefully within a dozen seconds. And that's, you want to get in the front end of that whole parade. Often what happens is you notice it like 4 hours in, or days, or weeks, or years. I don't know. It's often 4 hours. Okay, fine. But you want to get in there early as you can. Okay. The second thing is there's something deeply soothing about nature. You are on your land. You're with your animals. You are in these kind of primal currents, watering. Have you ever noticed that it's incredibly calming to water things? There's something about it. I remember when I was, we were flying once with our son. He was about a year and a half he was well behaved, but pretty cranky on the plane. I just took him to the bathroom. I'm sorry, all you other people who couldn't use the bathroom for the half hour he and I were in there. And we just played with water. Like that just chilled him out. You know, I don't know if he's done that with a little kid. So that's another thing. Yeah, okay. Maybe another question or comment or two, and then we'll take a break. Yeah.
I wrote down calm, contented, caring, and creative. I think there was one that...
Conscious was the first one.
Conscious.
Yeah. Okay. I'll say this and then we'll move to a break. The underlying idea is a basket of tools. It's very interesting that as the Buddha taught, he taught a long time, 40 years, right, roughly. He offered a diversity of skillful means. And we talk about diversity, racial, sexual orientation, gender, and those are important, but those, from the standpoint of evolution and the body, are very superficial, generally irrelevant forms of diversity. We make them relevant. So in society, we construct a relevance, but they're actually not very relevant. Whereas neurological diversity, temperamental diversity, constitutional diversity, that's really relevant. That's in deep, you know? And the Buddha had a lot of practices. He had a whole diversity of practices for people, because then people would find what worked for themselves at this time with this situation. And that's a lot the idea. It's to have a diversity of tools so you can have a sense of efficacy and you can do things so that we can do things to help ourselves feel better, right? You know, we're very vulnerable to learned helplessness. It's so interesting that mammals can be trained into learned helplessness really fast. It only takes a half dozen experiences of helplessness to teach a dog that there's nothing it can do, ever. And it'll just lie there on the electrified floor sizzling, and it won't get up and move because nothing you can do. You know what I mean? But it takes 100 trials, roughly, of dragging that dog off the electrified floor to teach it, if you just get up and walk across the line, dummy, you're going to be okay. See what I mean? We're very vulnerable to learned helplessness. That's why it's so important to focus on a sense of efficacy, a sense that we can do things to help ourselves. That was deeply embedded in the Buddha's teaching, in the Dharma. There's always something you can do, even if it's just inside your own mind, that you just be with what it is. You know, a broken hip, a tragedy, whatever. There's always something we can do. Okay? Okay, great. So let's do something. Let's take a break. So how about 15 minutes? Back at 10:02? Great. Thanks. Maybe we'll turn on some fans, get a little airflow. Thank you.